Welcome everyone to another day here at the Damage Report. It is Tuesday Newsday, and so we brought a true newsman coming back to the show after far too long of a gap. Michael Shore, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Great, it's good to be here. It's been a while, John. It really has. I mean,
it has, you know, months. I would assume. Yeah, I feel like the last time you were here, there was probably still hope that something might be done during Biden's first term. We're now moving past that. Anyway, look, we're into a new year, and it's been a weird one so far. Anything you can say that you've been up to recently? I don't know how much is secretive at this point, but how have you been? It's been a long time.
I've been great. And by the way, I should say in the defense of the president that a lot of what he's done is on defense, right? And that's not a sexy way to win a ball game, and also a tremendous infrastructure bill. But I know what the problems are too, and I'm not happy about those, and I don't put those all at the feet of the president. But that being said, it hasn't been as smooth a ride as we'd hoped. I've been good. I've been reporting at News Nation, which is a cable network, and reporting news and less politics than I have in a while. But
interesting.
Hope to be getting, but yeah, I know that's been an issue. But we'll get back into politics. It's also not been the worst time in the world to be out of reporting politics for a moment.
That's probably true. And just to be clear, News Nation, not Newsmax.
Right.
Yeah. Not there are differences.
Not one American News Nation either. It's just
okay. No. No. You can conceivably still see Michael in the future on AT&T. Anyway. With that said, we do have a lot we're going to be talking about, especially because we're starting a little bit late today. So over the course of the next 90 or so minutes, we're going to be breaking down the recent developments in California, the effort to pass single payer healthcare. We've got updates on how involved Donald Trump was in multiple different efforts to overturn the last election. We've got death threats, and we've got road rage, and we've got conspiracy theories, and we got a bunch of different stuff. All of that has been true of pretty much every episode of the show for 3 years. But we have developments. I swear it's news. I looked up the definition, it fits. Anyway, with all that said, if you wouldn't mind hitting the like button and sharing the stream, that would be great so that people know we're live, and you can send us comments, tweets, super chats, all that as we go, and we will respond. But with all that said, are you ready to do this, Michael?
I am I mean, at this point, if I'm not ready after all these months of waiting to come back on, it would be
just waiting by the phone as the days roll by, I doubt it. But anyway,
it's John.
Yeah. Okay, with that said, let's do this thing. Heading into this week, we knew that California had the chance once again to launch into a single payer healthcare system. That does not mean that a lot of lefties who were watching this had much hope, but they did think it could pass or it could get voted down. We could get the single payer healthcare, or at least we would know on the record those who refused to vote for it. But even that proved naive in hindsight because they didn't even vote on it. Assembly Bill 1400 by Assemblyman Ash Kalra did not have the necessary votes to move forward ahead of a key deadline Monday. Instead of forcing a vote that could be, in the words of the LA Times, politically damaging for some of his Democratic colleagues, Kalra opted to let the bill die. And so we did not even get a vote. I was watching it live, actually. And when they suddenly adjourned, I thought, wait, did I not get how this was supposed to go? I mean, I'm watching a live session of the legislature. There's a very good chance I was misreading the schedule, but no, they just didn't vote for it, Michael, which I guess was always an option, but I would have liked to have had people go on the record.
Yeah, you know, in the sort of the political fantasy of it, you want people to go on the record for doing it. It's also why they didn't have a vote. You know, it's a better odd year bill in terms of political practicality than it is an election year bill. And you have assembly, you have people running for assembly and state senate. And again, those aren't always even years. But the issue that you have here is that there is the question of how this would have been funded, and that in California that gets put to the people. And in a year where the Democrats are trying to win back House seats and trying to keep as many Republicans away from the ballot box as possible, a tax increase that would be brought to the people was really problematic. People I spoke to in Sacramento said that that was actually the reason why a lot of people didn't want to go on the record supporting this, even if they believed it. Now, that's political cowardice at the same time, right? I mean, there is some reality, but the cowardice here is that if progressives are going to lead, they're going to lead in California. They've always been first on most progressive issues here in the state of California. So that when you go then and you say, well, here's something that, you know, statewide, this CalCare, this is publicly funded healthcare. If we're not going to test it and be able and sort of have the chutzpah to do it in California, then where is it going to be done? But it really was because working against them in California was the fact that this is something, this tax increase is something that would go to the voters as well, rather than stay in Sacramento. And that's a big problem in California.
Yeah, I get it's an election year. I mean, the downside is 50% of years are congressional election years. The ones that aren't often have special elections that we would be worried about. The one next year is going to be a big Democratic presidential primary year, in theory at least. So that's also, it's just there's a lot of time that can get carved out as too dangerous to do anything.
No question, that's what I'm saying. There's never a perfect time, so why not just do it? There is an elevated fear of getting onto the ballot in an even year election, some kind of a referendum that voters are going to have to vote on to raise taxes, to somehow come up with the funds for paying for this. And that was in the, you know, that was in the assembly. They knew that. And I think it was just a reluctance to bring a vote on a tax increase at a time after COVID and at a time after pandemic, or during pandemic, we should say. There is political practicality to that, but again, it's consistent with the politics of fear rather than saying, no, we are going to do this because most people want this, right? I mean, healthcare is something that is popular among the populace. So that's why you push it forward. And I sort of think you have to have a little bit of nerve. You have to have an ability to bring this without fear. And Democrats are not good at bringing things forward without fear.
Yeah. And then look, they have a supermajority in the assembly. Like at a certain point, what is a mandate for?
Right.
And like just business as usual? Maybe. Look, I agree that I think fear is definitely a part of it. I also think that there is money as well. We're gonna turn to that in a sec. It's really fast, just to add a little bit of context to what we're talking about. AB 1400 would have created a publicly financed healthcare system called CalCare, which would cost between $314 billion and $391 billion in state and federal funds. So we currently in California spend about $330 billion on healthcare. So somewhere in the middle of what that system would cost. They were considering in one of CalRA's other bills that also we did get a vote on, a 1% payroll tax increase for those earning basically more than $50,000. And obviously this what I'm about to show you isn't enough by itself to pay for it, but we have this record budget that just got, or I don't know if it was approved yet. I think it was approved, but there's a projection of a $46 billion surplus in California. So again, that by itself isn't going to buy single payer healthcare, but we are basically paying that amount and the state is generating a surplus. The other side of the money thing is the lobbying effort against this. So you had the California Chamber of Commerce saying it's going to be a job killer, and they combined with dozens of different insurers and industry groups and associations have run social media ads and put out letters attacking this and trying to scare Democrats away from it. Now, on the other side, you do have activists. You have, for instance, California nurses, which we'll go to in a minute. But you also had sort of high level proponents of this. So supposedly, Governor Gavin Newsom was a fan. He endorsed single payer during his campaign for governor, but he has declined to comment on what just happened. In 2017, he was outspoken in support of creating a system. Now, not so much, doesn't want to talk about it, probably thinking about running for president. And there's nothing that launches you into a presidential primary like being the guy who in theory could have made this happen and didn't. I mean, I guess you'll still get money from insurance like Big Pharma and stuff like that. You get those donations. There are gonna be lots of people running in the primary for 2024 that get money from big corporations. There aren't gonna be a lot of ones who set up a single payer healthcare system in, you know, the fourth largest economy in the world. So I just, again, it feels like more of the cowardice that you were talking about it, and I'm absolutely sick of it. I don't know why the Democrats aren't as scared of continuing to accomplish almost nothing in the eyes of the people. I wish they could be scared of that like they are about, oh no, the taxes went up by 1%.
Right, I mean, and yeah, I have a difficult time putting this at the feet of the governor. And the governor is on the record already saying that it's something that he's interested in doing. That he's not talking about it is fine. He's saying, all right, this is the domain of the legislature. But as you said, you have a supermajority. If not now, when? And if this is an issue that a lot of Californians are passionate about, why be afraid of it? And you can make the argument that there is that this will. No, look, everybody says, and Democrats always say this will pay for itself. It's always, you know, it varies between partially true and mostly true, and that's a good zone to be in politics. But what they have to understand is there's a way to spin this, even if there is a tax increase that goes to the people, right? I mean, they are going to have to vote on a referendum, a proposition to raise a tax. There are ways to go against that and say that that's not really going to, you know, that this is not an exact tax increase. This is a reallocation of funds that the people are going to have. I mean, you can play with the language of this.
I agree.
But the crux of it is that they need to be a little ballsier about this, and eventually that's going to happen. It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely think that should be a part of the argument. And when I bring up Gavin Newsom, I'm not saying that he single-handedly killed it or anything like that. But he's who's bigger in California? Like, he should be weighing in. Biden isn't responsible for whether, you know, the Manchin and Sinema ever move on the filibuster, but he could certainly be very vocal about it. Like. Yeah. In any event, I want to give you a response from some who'd been pushing for this for some time. California Nurses Association said, nurses condemn this failure by elected representatives to put patients above profits, especially during the worst surge of COVID-19 yet, at a time when it's more clear than ever before that healthcare must be a right, not just a privilege for those who can afford it. Nurses are especially outraged that Calvert chose to just give up on patients across the state. Nurses never give up on our patients, and we will keep fighting with our allies in the grassroots movement for CalCare until all people in California can get the care they need, regardless of ability to pay. So look, they're obviously, they're gonna be a bit frustrated about this. And this is certainly time when, you know, public health, like the stakes have been even more real for the last 2 years than before. A lot of the economic components of it have become very real for a lot of people, a lot of families. And so we're just once again wondering, like back in 2017, the last time that they had a chance and they didn't do it. Like, Michael, are you free sometime in like 2027 to come back on, and we could talk about the next iteration of this?
Well, am I gonna have to wait that long again? I mean,
maybe
a few months long enough. Yeah, but yeah, I guess I'm probably free to talk about this. I mean, look, you have to be hopeful, right? I mean, you have to be hopeful that they're getting incrementally closer. But this is the really frustrating part, is they are set up to do this now. This is the time to do this because they have the support to do it. They have nurses behind them. They have people behind them. They have the supermajority. I don't know what has to change. And if it's fear of a referendum, if it's fear of going and having people having to raise the taxes, and that will bring people out who might not ordinarily vote, I think that's a small number of people, to be honest.
I agree. Okay, I'm gonna we're gonna be breezing through what should be our first break. I'm gonna read just a couple of the initial comments that came in, then we're gonna jump into our next story. First, though, I did want to let you know a big bit of news. Oh, okay. No, we're gonna take an actual break. We'll be back after this. Okay, everybody, lots more to talk about. Let's jump right into it. Over the last year, as the January 6th committee has begun to spool up their operations, they've reached out to a lot of people in the former president's circle to get their cooperation. Some have cooperated, many have been incredibly intransigent. One, right beside me, Kayleigh McEnany, former White House press secretary, apparently is cooperating at least to some extent. She has reportedly handed over potentially explosive text messages to the House panel. ABC News reports that she is fully cooperating with House investigators, and the text messages she provided have already proved to be useful to them. Although there's literally no more context than that on what that means, how useful, in what area. Anyway, one exchange that we had previously known about between Kayleigh McEnany and Sean Hannity on the day after the January 6th insurrection, he urged her to tell Trump to stop describing the election as stolen. That was recently quoted in a letter the committee sent to Ivanka Trump. On top of those text messages, McEnany also provided several hours of testimony to the investigators on January 13th. Neither McEnany nor the committee commented on the report, and that leaves us not knowing a lot about what the content of the testimony was. I mean, Eric Trump and Alex Jones testified, but it was them pleading the fifth for like a solid 6 hours. So is that what she did? Was it more useful? She was around Trump on January 6th. So she's one of those, like Ivanka Trump, that I think could provide the most new information. Michael, what are your thoughts? What are your expectations?
Well, look, I think that we have to be happy whenever we see somebody cooperating with the committee. We're not going to know what they're saying precisely. We're not going to know it for a while. But when the committee, the committee's been doing its work in a way that invites people in, and then we know when they don't come in. But when they do, we don't know everything that they're saying, and that's probably a good thing. I mean, I think that's a hat tip to Thompson, the way he's run that committee. So I can't pretend to know what she's talking about, but I think it's good. The more people that speak, even if they're people that you don't necessarily love, the better it is for the work that Congress has to do. So I'm not going to be skeptical of how helpful these people are being. I'm going to trust that the committee says they're helpful, and they're helpful certainly in contrast to the people that just don't come in and do as Eric Trump and Alex Jones did, as you said, John. So there is a big difference.
Yeah, that's true. I also might be more predisposed to pointless speculation than you. So, like, for instance, I look at recent appearances by Kayleigh McEnany on like Fox News. And she hasn't been breaking like huge ground or anything, but she's appearing on there regularly. It's not the sort of stance of like one like Stephanie Grisham, who's been very hostile, obviously, towards the administration.
You have to be realistic about it, too. You can't expect that from Kayleigh McEnany. She is who she is. The fact that there may be sort of some grain of integrity hiding in there on something that she thinks is important, or she's been asked to, or her lawyers have advised her to disclose, doesn't matter. Even if they're the worst reasons, if she is cooperating with the committee, that's all you can ask for, because that's not what you're getting from a lot of these people, and it's what the committee wants.
Exactly. I want to check in, because we don't have you on a ton. We obviously are in an election year now, and it's an election year that has a, I think, very significant chance of ending with the Republicans taking over the House. And I have a feeling, were they in charge, the January 6th committee would look a little bit different. So what do you think that likelihood, what effect might that have on the committee? Are they going to try to rush out some sort of preliminary findings, knowing that they might not exist in a year, or that the closer they get to the election, the more likely it is to be dismissed as just partisan election tampering? What do you think is going to happen this year in regards to this committee?
I mean, I think there's a timeline that they know. They know that it won't be in existence. There are members of that committee that won't be in Congress in the next Congress. So there are reasons that they have this timeline that is going to expire. And I think that they're going to want to make it somewhat apolitical. They now have to balance the attention they would get. Not that they're playing it entirely like this at all. but there's going to be a Supreme Court nomination, and then there is going to be the January 6th committee. I would imagine, skeptical or not, this Donald Trump isn't on the ballot necessarily in 2022. And I think that Republicans who are on the record of supporting the president, if they find out that there was something, you know, as nefarious as we think happened on January 6th, then for sure you're going to get some results that people say taint the election. It doesn't matter if they taint the election at all, and it's right, then that's fine. So they know the timeline. They know that the election is coming up, and Congress could change hands. They're not going to let this linger into next year. They're not going to let it linger into late October either. I think this is going to be something late summer, early fall that you're going to hear about.
Okay, good. That's good. It feels like it's been going on for some time. I would like some new information to come out.
Yeah, and depending on the Supreme Court nomination, how that goes. Mm-hmm.
Well, we do actually have a little bit of an update to jump into right now. We've known for some time that there was an effort, a multi-pronged effort, to potentially seize voting machines in the wake of the 2020 presidential election. That has been alluded to and updated along the way. What is new now this week is a greater understanding of how involved President Donald Trump was with this effort. It had previously been possible that this was something his aides in various aspects of government had been working on, but no, he was actually involved. And the New York Times describes this involvement in a bit flowery language, saying, 6 weeks after Election Day, with his hold on power slipping, President Donald J. Trump directed his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to make a remarkable call. Mr. Trump wanted him to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states. They have three different sources on that information. Giuliani did make that call. He called the department's acting deputy secretary, who said he lacked the authority to audit or impound the machines. After that, Mr. Trump pressed Giuliani to make that inquiry to have outside advisors, wanted to have the Pentagon take control. They had outreach to the Department of Homeland Security. He had a meeting with Attorney General William Barr, who said that the Justice Department also couldn't seize it. At the same time, he was trying to persuade state lawmakers in states like Michigan and Pennsylvania to have local law enforcement do this. We had known about some of these plots, but he apparently was actually directly involved in conversations about the DOJ, DHS, the Department of Defense, and state lawmakers all independently trying to seize control of voting machines. Now, thankfully, people did not play ball, those who would actually have to do this. It did not actually happen, but he was involved in it. Michael, thoughts?
My thought is that if this is true, then Donald Trump should be arrested. I mean, I think that we're getting into the territory where he was doing extra legal, trying to take extra legal measures to get a hold of the election and change the course of you know, what everybody, I think, or not, I shouldn't say everybody because it's not true, but most people think was a legal election. And so to that end, I do think we're getting into the territory where Donald Trump broke the law or tried to break the law. And even Giuliani at some point wouldn't go to the military to try and get that done. And I say even Giuliani because he seemed to have been willing to do anything at a certain point. So I think this extra legal stuff that Trump did is worthy of arrest, frankly, if it's true. And these are things that we will soon learn.
And so I'm curious. So I assume you're saying that some of what we had previously learned doesn't seem to have risen to that level or have the evidence for it. In, for instance, the alternate electors, the pressure on the vice president, the call to Raffensperger to find votes, those sorts of things are either not proven to the same extent or aren't as clearly illegal.
Well, if you go through them one by one, I think the call to Raffensperger maybe as well. I mean, there may be multiple counts here, right? I'm just saying this is another one of those where he broke the law. I mean, I think to pressure the vice president, I don't know that, and I'm not a lawyer, I don't know that is against the law. I think that it would have been against the law had the vice president succumbed to that, perhaps, but definitely. But as far as talking about what the president, the pressure he tried to exert on the Secretary of State in Georgia, what we've now learned he tried to do with voting machines through the Department of Homeland Security. To their credit, they didn't allow it to happen. I think that that this is flirting with breaking the law, if it isn't outright blatantly breaking the law. And again, it's for other people to decide, but certainly this adds more to the cumulative and growing case against Donald Trump.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that case has been pretty plump for a long time, I feel like.
Oh, it has
actually happened.
I'm not breaking news here by saying that. I mean, we've thought this for a while. I mean, we've thought at different times, sitting in the Oval Office with James Comey. I mean, there's so many different times where it seems that got him, you know, he was impeached twice, which happens to presidents, but he's a former president now. We're learning some of these things. Did he say, will he say, will his lawyer say he had executive privilege? Perhaps, but I think that, you know, it goes too far. It's what caused Nixon to resign, because he knew that as well.
Yeah, and by us covering this and talking about it, I'll speak for myself. Feel free to disagree. Again, doesn't mean that we have any reasonable expectation that anything will be done. In part because so much has been revealed and nothing has been done. But I feel like, in the absence of a political system where there are actually legal consequences for illegal acts, we can't really seem to have that. We should at least still acknowledge the crimes. We can move on afterward or whatever, but I feel like we should at least point out what we think is being done.
Yeah, I'm plus one to that with you, but I also think that you're seeing a fraying support system for the former president. And I think because of that, it's not happening with, you know, in a deluge of people breaking with him, but people are sort of Republicans sticking their feet in the water to test whether or not distance themselves from the president's okay. Yeah. And it's proven to be a little more safe than people had thought. So if that continues to be contagious, then you may see the president, the former president, in bigger trouble.
Okay. With that said, let's jump into very different news. Threats of a variety of forms of violence against universities are, unfortunately, in the United States, not particularly rare. In fact, just over the last 24 hours, as we launch into Black History Month, 13 different HBCUs received death threats, bomb threats specifically. Just in like a 24-hour period. But these sorts of threats can come in a variety of different forms. And we want to profile one specific one for you that it was sent to UCLA. This is coming from a former postdoctoral researcher who had this massive manifesto and a series of threatening videos. This was from the philosophy department at the University of California, Los Angeles. They, in response to this threat, canceled in-person classes after one of their postdoctoral researchers and lecturers sent an 800-page manifesto to staff members and posted a video to YouTube on Sunday entitled UCLA Philosophy Mass Shooting. So mass shooting was in the title of the video. Footage in the video shows clips from a 2017 mass shooting in Las Vegas and from the 2003 movie Zero Day. The video has since been removed from the platform. But there was a period of about a day where this individual uploaded 350 different videos with titles like UCLA philosophy is racist and openly racist, or I'm a pedophile, ladies, I'm a pedophile, and quote, how to kill an enemy. And so UCLA says their police department is aware of this threat and they're looking into it, has since been identified as a former teacher, Matthew Harris, who had taught courses like philosophy of race. But with just the sheer volume in this, Michael, I can imagine being pretty terrified if I was in that department.
Yeah, unquestionably. And this is, I mean, in a sense, something was cut off at the pass here, right? I mean, this could have gotten to be a lot worse. And you look back at a lot of the violence against schools. And really, I mean, this is a lot like violence in the workplace. People who come in and take retributive action that is totally deranged against places where they worked. So it could have been a whole lot worse than it was. And we've seen it manifest accepted in other places. So it's not to this. This combines two of America's shameful activities, which is violence in school and violence in the workplace, and it brings them together. And so I think that, look, anytime this kind of stuff is averted, even if you know it's imperfect, and you can say, well, how didn't they know this before, or whatever, I think you've got to be a little happy that it was that they avoided something that could have been there.
Definitely. And by the way, I want to remind you that while during the pandemic we had less violence at schools, specifically mass shootings, shootings at schools have begun to rise once again. And you can see the absolute jump in this chart we're going to show you for last year in comparison with these gun incidents at schools doubling from one year to the next.
Well, I mean, so, can I also say that people weren't in school as much last year, and now that they're going back to school and they've gone back to school, so too the shootings.
Exactly, I would agree. Okay, with that, we're gonna mix things up. I'm gonna read just a couple of quick comments, and then we're gonna talk a little bit about the future of the GOP, a little bit of fundraising information. It actually might play into a bit of what Michael was saying before about the support structure for the president, but it should be interesting, so stay tuned. First though, Progressive Canuck, aka the Maple Syrup Dragon, has been a member for 6 months, says, thank you, John, for covering the unmarked graves yesterday and how you covered it. I feel other countries outside of Canada have not been covering it. I mean, some good, places like, it's the sort of thing that NPR, Vice, Democracy Now!, those sorts of places will talk about it. I'm sure it's been covered a little bit elsewhere. I don't know if you've seen more coverage of the residential schools incidents with Canada.
I've seen it, but I listened to it actually on NPR and didn't see it.
Oh yeah, okay. Lin Siekby hit 11 months. I probably butchered that, doing it phonetically, but thank you for being with us for 11 months on Bezos Bucks. Thank you for that. Arsenic0721 hit. Oh sure, yes, that is true. Okay, gifted subs, thank you as always. And with that, we'll jump into our next story. One of the ways that Donald Trump wants to continue to make his mark on the GOP in this electoral cycle is through endorsements. Now that path became a little bit more complicated when we found out last week that he's now considering endorsing multiple candidates in the same race. I don't know what that counts for at that point, but there's also one other issue. And in particular, in some of the cases where he has endorsed challengers to the Republicans that he hates more than anything else in the world, some of those Republicans he despises and wants to drive out of the party are actually doing much better than their contenders in fundraising. So according to new financial reports, they're outraising their primary opponents. I want to give you some examples though. Representative Liz Cheney, still technically a Republican, although most Republicans would seem to not want that to be, more than quadrupled the fourth quarter fundraising haul of her top primary opponent, fellow Republican Harriet Hagerman. Cheney raised over $200 million to less than half a million from Hagerman. Lisa Murkowski brought in nearly $1.4 million the fourth quarter of the last year. Her Trump-backed challenger raised just over $600,000. I believe Kelly Shibaka is the individual who released the spirit language video. That apparently was not a big a donor stimulus, having the made up language that God blessed. Anyway, Fred Upton raised about $726,000, more than five times what primary rival Steve Kara raised. And there's other instances as well. Now, I don't know, Michael, are you surprised by this? A lot, these are incumbents, so generally they are going to raise more money, but Republicans also kind of hate people who don't support Trump, and yet they are giving the money still.
Well, I wouldn't read too much into this other than it's good news if you don't like Donald Trump and you don't like his candidates. Look, the power structure of incumbency, we know what it is. They're getting it from all the regular places, from individuals, but also from unions that or groups that would support the incumbent, because the incumbent has presumably kept their interests in hand as they've been there. I shouldn't say unions, but I'm talking about groups that would typically typically chambers of commerce, that sort of thing, that would typically support the Republican. The other part of it is the Never Trump organization was largely made up of what was the Republican moderate establishment or very conservative establishment that was not in the Trump camp. And that was the moneyed part of the Republican Party. Donald Trump's appeal went to a lot of the very, much less well-to-do Republicans who would not be giving high dollar amounts in campaigns, especially out of state.
Yeah.
I mean, so there, but I think it does tell you something. It certainly tells you that just the Donald Trump endorsement has not proven to be enough for these people. But there are reasons also to not just sort of jump to conclusions about it, because a lot of, a lot like what I just said, a lot of the moneyed interests in the Republican Party are not Trump supporters, and the ones that are Trump supporters don't have as much money.
Yeah, or might be willing to support him if he is the leader, but also have their own independent interests outside of just him.
Yeah, there's no question. Also, a lot of Trump support came from political neophytes, and political neophytes can be standing in Indiana and interested in their Indiana race, but they're not going to write a check to Lisa Murkowski or her challenger in Alaska. Whereas, someone who's been doing this in politics for a while would be more inclined to do that, because they also would have more money to do it with.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Well, while some of his the people he's backing might have a little bit of trouble with fundraising, one individual who has not had trouble with fundraising is the former president Donald Trump. He begins this year with $122 million in political cash. He raised $51 million in the last half of last year, which was actually down from the $62 million he raised in the first half of the year. So, fresh off an election loss and an attempted coup, people handed him $62 million. He wasn't even really in the public eye. He wasn't tweeting. He wasn't really doing rallies at that point. And they showered him with tens of millions of dollars. And by the way, he's raised all this money. And as we've said, he wants other candidates to want his endorsement. He wants to be the kingmaker. Well, he's not doing much financial kingmaking. In the last half of last year, he raised that $51 million. He only gave other candidates 1.5 of it. And 1 million of that went to a nonprofit where Mark Meadows serves as a senior partner, which is its own issue with campaign finance. But he isn't doing much financial support of candidates.
No, I mean, he's a huckster, he's a cult leader. And it's curious as to why people give money to cult leaders. It's curious why hundreds of people that, move to Guyana to follow a cult leader. And this is how it's playing out with Donald Trump. And the truth is that this money goes to him. He doesn't spend it on other candidates, like you just said, John, and it still doesn't stop the flow of money to Donald Trump. So he's fooling people. He's fooling people regularly. He's making them part with their money. I'm on all of his email lists. They come in every day asking for money. They're fooling me into thinking that Donald Trump is going to have dinner or lunch with me, that he's going to sign this thing for me, that he's going to make me a certain level of title within his organization. And that's how they give the money. And that's how he has so much money stockpiled.
Yeah, 100%. Anyway, with that said, everyone, prepare yourself for a video that features some gun-based violence. Consider that your warning as we jump into this video. So what you just saw is a video of a driver, Ed Popper, driving his Toyota Venza hybrid and is in the Miami area getting cut off. It's an experience that many of us have had. We've been singing along to a song, swearing at the terrible driving around us. For most of us though, we didn't have a gun in the car, so that's where the video would end. That would be the end of it. We'd be angry, maybe we'd flip the bird, we'd swear, and then we'd move on with our lives. Some people though drive around with guns, and that means that video you just saw can escalate into this. And that is what turned it from a normal instance of road rage to an incident that has left Ed Popper, the man in the video, awaiting trial on two felony charges, including aggressive assault with a firearm that could land him in up to 15 years in prison. Because when the guy that cut him off and then they swore at each other drove back beside him, he took out his gun and began wildly firing 11 shots through his own window and windshield, potentially killing the man who'd cut him off, potentially killing anyone else who just happened to be in the area, potentially killing him if it turned out he wouldn't be able to see out of his windshield anymore. He apparently didn't think about any of this, not even to the extent that he would roll down his window. He just had a gun, so he used the gun that he had. And as crazy as all of what you just saw is, all of what happened afterward is almost as weird. So both drivers pulled over after the incident and called 911. Both drivers, along with everyone else sharing the road, thankfully escaped unharmed. Thankfully, he didn't kill anyone with those 11 wild shots that day. And somehow they pulled over, and I don't know how close they were to each other, but it seems very weird that they would both pull over afterward. And I guess we're just past the shots that I fired. Now, Ed Popper claims that the Camry driver had a weapon and fired at him first. So don't worry, this was self-defense. And you might have heard in the video, there's a bang against the Toyota Venza as the Camry passes. Popper's attorney believes that the sounds prove Popper was shot at first. The Camry driver told police that he had merely thrown a water bottle at Popper's car and that he did not have a firearm with him. But they say, nope, it was a shot. That proves that this was self-defense. There are a few issues with that. One, from the video, it looks like the guy leaned out and threw something at the car, which, by the way, as a small note, don't throw something at someone else's car. It's a terrible idea, whether they have a gun or not. And this is America, so there's a good chance they will. Don't throw anything at their car. Two, they're gonna be able to look at the side of the car, and I have a feeling a water bottle dent and a shot to the side of the Venza are gonna look very different. So his argument that this justifies self-defense, that's a defense that feels like it's gonna fall apart pretty quickly. As well as the fact that in the video, we can see that he pulled out the gun way before the guy drove up beside him and threw the water bottle at his car. This guy was prepping to shoot. Now, maybe if the guy hadn't thrown the bottle, he wouldn't have. But in the footage, it looks like he was prepping to do it as the car began to approach. This looked like it was attempted murder at that point. We'll leave it to the judge and the jury to figure out. Anyway, for now, in advance of some sort of legal consequences, Ed Popper has already lost his job. He was an inspector with the Miami Beach Fire Department. So again, he was a public figure, vested with authority, looked up to and respected, carrying a gun around that he's ready to start just emptying his clip at anyone that bothers him on his commute. He was released on bond. He has a hearing set for April. We'll have to see what happens. It's apparently in Florida, so God only knows what they'll end up ruling when they hear this self-defense argument. Okay, well, that said, we're gonna jump into something very different. I honestly don't know how you're gonna respond to this. This was brought to my attention by J.R. Jackson. So we're gonna jump into a video in 1 second. I wanna give a content advisory notice because there is a lot of harsh language, racial slurs, but they should all be bleeped out still. That said, this is what we're gonna do. So let's launch into this video.
You know,
thing.
Yes. Saying the word.
You've already said
D is just like
saying
she's calling you. It's like this boy that he's and starts calling them word. There should be a word like, especially like the word that's about.
He says guy, and then saying allowed to use the word out the word
word. He couldn't say.
So, although they were bleeped out, every one of those bleeps represents a different instance of Joe Rogan saying the N-word fully and proudly and across seemingly many years, because there were so many different sets that were represented there. But that was all collected by Patriot Takes, which has the uncensored version on their Twitter account. We Just want to throw this out as a bit of added context. People are taking a second look at Joe Rogan and his legacy and his place in media. So a bit of context. He has said that word a lot of times, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this morning on Patriot Takes on their Twitter feed. The thing that struck me was how comfortable he is saying it. Obviously the multiple instances, not that he was saying it with venom. It's a word that has venom implicit in it. It's the worst word. But he was so comfortable saying it, whereas it gives everybody pause hearing it, or I shouldn't say everybody, it gives good thinking people pause just to hear it. He's so comfortable saying it, and it was really disturbing. It's really disturbing that so many people defend him.
Yeah, I understand. So some people were defending him even in that thread, saying, yeah, but they're leaving out the context. I mean, I like to think that I have an open mind and I can conceive of vast, complex worlds of possibility. How much context could there exist to say the word that many times? I mean, right. I've thought back on my life, Michael, and I can definitely think of two instances where I have heard that word said, like just outright a white person saying it. In a bar in Austin, this guy said it to me while talking about the Yankees. It was one of the weirdest experiences of my life. And a guy I knew growing up, I remember, once said it to me while playing a video game. And there's the random people on Xbox Live that yell it at you and all that. But I've now heard Joe Rogan say it way more than everyone else in my life combined. So there's a bit of life context for you.
No, it's crazy. And the most shocking thing about the story about the bar that you were in was that someone was actually talking to you about sports. But
I was already uncomfortable with the conversation before the Rachel Surz dropped.
That must have been like a double for you. That's just it. It's not something that people say. It's not something people hear well, and it's inexcusable.
Yeah. And by the way, I have no idea if he still does. I don't know. I believe I'm not a listener. It looked like his current set was represented several times, but he might have been on that set for 3 or 4 years. I don't know how recent it's been or anything like that. And I understand, by the way, I was talking with Jared before the show. What's that?
Does it matter how recent it was? I mean,
I'm just putting it out there to stupidly, naively to try to rebut some of what the instantaneous knee-jerk defenders will say. I understand that there was a debate that I think is over now about whether it was appropriate years ago to quote it. So if you were saying that someone was saying it, should you say it then? And I was always uncomfortable with that. Yeah. But I do not believe that that is what is happening here. I'm just putting it out there. I don't have much skin in the game for Joe Rogan. He's gonna be just fine. This video going out there is not gonna hurt it. I have a feeling much of his base is going to find one way or another to be perfectly fine with that legacy.
Right, except for Neil Young fans.
Well, of which he is one, apparently, according to him. Anyway, by the way, in that thread, and you should check out Patriot Takes thread, there's also an instance where he was telling a story about going to see Planet of the Apes. And he says, we walked into Planet of the Apes, going into a theater where apparently there were not a lot of white people. He said, we walked into Planet of the Apes. We walked into Africa, dude. We walked in the door and there was no white people. He once said to a guest who said he has a black dad and a white mom, powerful combination genetic wise, right? You get the body of the black man and then you get the mind of the white man all together in some strange combination. Black people have a different brain. A guy who taught his dog to do a Nazi salute. It was cute. Quote, no Jews got gassed during the making of that video. And I have absolutely no doubt that he will say that those last two and possibly all of them are jokes. Yeah, there's a genre of joke like that. Yeah. It's not one of the ones that you usually use in public. The Apes,
not a joke. That's racist. That's ugly.
No, what I meant is it's a racist joke. That's what I'm saying. That's the genre. Yeah. Racist joke.
Really, really, really ugly. People have lost lives and jobs for that. And he just goes on motoring right along. Jimmy the Greek Snyder, who was a tout on television and football, said things like that about, you know, when Joe Rogan was just describing the white black father and white mother, he said horrible generalization once or twice and he was off the air, and that was 30, 40 years ago. And this guy can just get away with this garbage every day. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, and I have no doubt that us even just putting it out there and raising it as a topic to maybe think about, we will be hated far more than him for this. So that's the way the modern media environment works, regrettably. Also, super fast, after yesterday saying that he is going to do a bit more thinking and preparation before giving people medical advice, he spread an already debunked claim that ivermectin had just been shown to help fight COVID. It had already been debunked like 10 hours earlier. His tweet got over 100,000 likes. He eventually deleted it after 100,000 likes were. Anyway, that is unfortunately all the time we have. Michael, are you going to have to step out?
I have to step out. Well,
it's great to have you back as always.
I love being back here, John. I will stay the entire time next time.
Awesome.
That soon. All right.
Thank you very much. Everyone at home, we've got more. We're going to take a short break, but don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.